Hey everyone, this is Graham from Guru Focus. If you haven't met me already, I run our Value Investing Live series on YouTube. The podcast you're about to listen to was originally recorded live in front of an audience, so our guests may make references to charts and PowerPoint slides that you won't be able to see here. If you want to check out their full presentation, including those slides, or join our next live stream, click on the link down in the description. Now back to the podcast. All right. Welcome, everyone, to Value Investing Live. I am pleased to welcome back our guest this week, Gary Mishras. As a reminder, and for those of you that may have missed Gary's first appearance, he is the managing partner and chief investment officer of Silver Ring Value Partners, which operates with a concentrated long-term intrinsic value strategy. As always, for those of you out in the audience, especially those international audience members, please say hi to us there over in the chat. We love to see where you're coming from. Let us know you're hearing us loud and clear. And do please feel free to post those questions and comments in that chat section throughout the presentation. But keep in mind, we will go ahead and hold those until we get to the Q&A at the end of things as we cruise through Gary's presentation here. Without anything further from me, I'll go ahead, hand things over to Gary, and we can jump into things.
Well, Graham, thank you so much for having me back, and I guess I passed the test, for a second appearance, so thank you, and really appreciate the time, and I appreciate the time of everyone who is listening. Thank you. All right, so I want to talk about really three things. You know, the most important thing comes at the end is your questions, because I want to make sure this is interactive and not just me droning on, which it is a danger, and I know, so don't fall asleep on me. There'll be a quiz. But I think the two main things I want to cover is investing patterns, what they are and how to use them, and also an example of one, and also the investment process in action, which is Sprouts Farmers Market, which is a company that the partnership that I manage, Silver Ring Value Partners, does own. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on myself. I'm not that interesting. You can see my background here. Graham did it justice. You know, Silver Ring Value Partners is a concentrated partnership. The idea is to try to compound capital safely at attractive rates over the long term. You know, really, I think about competitive advantage, I would say temperament is, I would say, the biggest, which is the ability to act rationally when all kinds of crazy stuff is happening and there are all kinds of pressures on you to act irrationally. But I'm a microeconomics investor. I am a long-term oriented, and so are my partners. And the asset base is nimble enough and allows basically for a opportunity to invest in inefficient parts of the market. The philosophy is a long-term intrinsic value approach with a margin of safety and rational and disciplined execution and a concentrated portfolio. All right, enough about me. Let's talk about investing patterns because that's much more interesting. So I want to kind of talk about what is and isn't an investing pattern. I want to kind of walk through why they matter and also talk about four specific investing patterns that I have found to be useful. And they are definitely not the only ones, but they work for me, and maybe some of them will inform how you think about investing. All right. So, you know, before I start, I started my career 20 years ago at Fidelity, and my mentor there, Joel Tillinghast, who manages the Low Price Stock Fund, had a great little cartoon in one of his presentations that really stuck with me. And that's a guy walks into a store, and the storekeeper says, how can I help? And the customer says, well, I want high quality and low price. And the shopkeeper says, well, sure, I have both. Which one do you want? Right? So that's the punchline. The punchline is, so what's not an investing pattern? So it's cheap. That is, I know, might hurt me to say it, might hurt you to hear it if you're a value investor, but it's cheap as not an investing pattern. There are things that are cheap and deservedly cheap, or they're not cheap enough because they're on the verge of going bankrupt. It's a good business is also not a pattern. You can have a good business, but if you want to learn from someone about how good businesses can be bad investments, you don't need to look any further than Warren Buffett and his purchase, whether it's Precision Castparts or Kraft Heinz. He fully admitted his mistake, and just because something is a good business doesn't make it a good investment. The price matters, and it's growing rapidly is also not an investing pattern. You can grow rapidly and be undervalued, can be growing rapidly and be overvalued, and everything in the middle, right? You know, if you don't believe me, pick your fastest, highest growing company and pretend it's $1 trillion per share. Hopefully that will convince you that, there is a price at which the same company can be a bad investment versus a good investment. All right. So what's a mispricing? I know it's kind of like obvious. It's like, hey, Gary, what are you wasting your time for? We know what it is. But no, it's really important because it's a gap between expectations about the future cash flows that's implied by the market price. Let me repeat that. A gap between expectations about future cash flows implied by the market price and your expectations about future cash flows, formed hopefully based on thorough analysis, right? So the market is a discounting mechanism, and you know the price embeds a certain set of expectations about the future, and if you can justifiably disagree with that set of expectations, that's a mispricing. You know, everything else, is not, simplistically. So investing patterns. So what are investing patterns? I think the key is that they involve recurring mispricings in similar circumstances, right? They occur over and over again, and that's why that's what makes them patterns, and it's also what makes them useful. Because if you learn them, it'll kind of teach you how to do things, not just in a specific instance, but over and over again. And they need to be identifiable at the time of occurrence. Like, it's great if you're Monday morning quarterbacking and you're talking about how you could have bought this stock here or that stock there. That's not useful. What's useful is, can this phenomenon be taken advantage of in real time so you can make money? Because that's ultimately the objective here. So four patterns, as I promised. And I go a little bit, medium deep, into each one. And if you want me to go deeper, let's do this during Q&A because I want to make sure all of you are somewhat awake by the end of the presentation. And now the first and the easiest pattern is where I started 20 years ago as a young analyst, cyclicals, right? So a cyclical is a company where the profits are below historical levels because of either a general economic malaise, a recession perhaps, or an industry level problem, right? So there's no company specific problem. Every company in the industry is affected somewhat similarly. There may be different degrees, but everyone is impacted, and the company is earning less than it had historically. And let's use a simple example. Let's say the company has, in the past, averaged a dollar of free cash flow per share, and now it's earning 50 cents. Well, a lot of times, the way the market approaches it, and trust me, I've talked to many PMs who still believe this. I know that you're out there, and I respectfully but strongly disagree with you, is that the way you invest in cyclicals is that you wait for evidence of a cycle turn, right? And that is incorrect. The reason is it's incorrect because of those portfolio managers, they are waiting, and then their armies of analysts are waiting for the evidence, right? And you're not going to get a special bell to ring just in your ear to say, time to buy, cycle's turning. Now, you might get a lot of Wall Street research telling you that, but you're not their only customer, and by the way, they don't know when the cycle is going to turn, and neither do you, and neither do I. So how do you invest? I think the key is two things. One is you really need to be sure that the company is going through cyclical issues, not company-specific permanent issues. But once you establish that, it's really about price to value. Let's use the example of a dollar per share for profits on average, and let's say it's not growing, so maybe you think it's worth $10. And currently earning 50 cents, and the market might be pricing that at $4 or $5, right? Why would it do that? Because the market doesn't think it's cyclical. Maybe they just don't care because they're waiting for the cycle to turn and they haven't seen the inflection point yet. And so it's trading at 10 times current profits of $5 per share, and you think it should be worth 10 based on your assessment. If you buy it at 5 thinking it's worth 10, it almost doesn't matter when the cycle turns. If it turns in a year, you'll double your money very quickly. If it turns in 5 years, which is extremely unlikely, but possible, you'll still have a 15% annual rate of return. The key is price. And what doesn't work is buying a cyclical, early based on price, meaning you buy it early at 8 or 80% of value. And then by the time you come out on the other side, you've made 25%, but maybe it took you 3 years to make that return, and your annual returns is single digits, basically, per year. So the point here is cyclical is a matter of when, not if. Because it's a matter of when, not if, you don't want to wait for signs of anything. You want to be really sure it's cyclical, and you want to be really sure in your price-to-value relationship. All right, turnarounds. Turnarounds, on the other hand, is a company-specific problem, right? It's a company that's earning well less than its historical profitability for reasons that are really company specific. I can go to turnarounds and that could be a whole long presentation, but the point there is most turnarounds do not turn. And most novice investors, what they end up doing is they confuse what's possible with what's likely. So, you know, they have the management tell them, oh, we're going to earn, not to use the same example, you know, company used to earn a dollar per share, now it's earning 50 cents. Management comes in and says, we're going to earn a dollar again, and you kind of assume it's the likeliest scenario, the base case. Whereas in reality is, that's probably the best case. Or it might become the base case at a future point, but there's no evidence yet that it is. And two-thirds of turnarounds now turn. So you might say, well, you know, what do you do? And here you have to wait for evidence of improvement. You might say, well, Gary, you just told us not to do that with cyclicals. And I did. And the reason I did is because cyclicals was a matter of when. The if wasn't a question if you correctly analyzed the situation. With turnarounds, since two-thirds don't turn, you want really to skew the odds in your favor, and you would rather pay a somewhat higher price, but have a much higher probability of it turning. Now, how do you do that? Usually there's a three-year pattern to turnarounds. You know, new management comes in, they assess the problem, they have a strategy. Year number two, they start to implement it, and they have key performance indicators all down on the execution, and the company comes out. The key is to wait for evidence, but not wait for the income statement to get reflected evidence. And the reason is because if you wait for the income statement to reflect the evidence, what's going to happen is you're going to, you're going to miss, what's happening, right? And so I think what's, because everyone's waiting for that. But a lot of times management will disclose key performance indicators that they're using to track progress of the turnaround. And if you are following the story correctly, but if the key performance indicators make sense and they're pointing in the right direction, it's very unlikely that once the company starts to turn, it goes back and reverses. So you wait for those intermediate indicators, the odds then really shift in your favor. And if the price to value is still right, which frequently it is, because the income statement hasn't really reflected the turnaround yet, you can then make a good investment sometimes. The third pattern, and that's the one we're going to dive into in depth, is long duration above average growers. And that's basically, the idea here is the market really is focused on magnitude of growth. Like, have you ever heard anyone say, this is a 15-year grower, or this is a 20-year grower? They don't. They say this is a 15% grower or a 20% grower. Now, why? Because magnitude is, more exciting, more immediate. Who knows what the world looks like in 15, 20 years, right, or 10 years. So the market isn't very good at valuing companies that maybe the rate of growth is above average, but maybe it's, say, 10%, but it's not 20%. So 10% doesn't really get most people too excited. But there's a huge difference to the value of the business if the 10% is sustainable for 20 years as opposed to 5 years. And it's just mathematically the reality. But very few people think about that. And I don't think the markets do a very good job of thinking about that. So if you're able to find a company where your fundamental analysis tells you that there's a long tail to the above average growth, even if the rate isn't very high, that's a fertile ground for mispricings. And lastly, behavioral errors. So the idea is the first three patterns is you're kind of on a battlefield, right? It's an analytical battlefield, and you're matching your wits against other market participants analytically. You're valuing the cash flows, or maybe they're valuing the cash flows, maybe they're trying to guess who's going to beat the quarter, but they're thinking about, something, and it's a battle of ideas. And if you are more right there on average, you get, to earn an excess return. The fourth pattern is the opposite. It's people abdicate the battlefield completely because what's happening is there is a non-economic reason for their actions. And it might be as simple as forced selling from a liquidating portfolio, or it could be forced selling after a spin-off of a small subsidiary where the whole institutional holders don't want to have a small, tiny stub investment, left in their portfolios. They're not analyzing it deeply and saying, well, gee, it's undervalued. They're saying, I had a 0.5% position in the parent company. Now I have a 0.05% position also in this little, thing. It's small. It doesn't fit my mandate, maybe, whatever that means. And they kind of punted. So there's uneconomic behavior. They're not competing with you in terms of valuing this business. Or it could be just, you know, in a whole area of the market or an industry being in disfavor and people stopping at, you know, hello, kind of say, and, you know, not even analyzing it. I can give an example from my own experience. You know, I correctly avoided the debacle of the newspaper industry and the declining businesses there, where a lot of value investors fell for that and lost a lot of money. You know, going back to it's cheap is not a pattern. But I also missed the, you know, News Corp, where a smart, you know, analyst at a very, very large good value shop here in Boston was telling me at a company lunch, where like, hey, this is really undervalued, you should look at it. His point was, you know, there are all these other businesses other than the newspaper business in here, and the newspaper business doesn't really matter because you're buying the whole thing for less than the value of the other businesses. And, you know, essentially, I just couldn't get past that a lot of this company's revenues, the newspaper industry, and I was so proud of myself for avoiding it, I just didn't do the analysis. My guess is neither did the market, because the stock did quite well, and kudos to him and shame on me. But it's, again, it's absence of analysis, and then it's emotionally driven non-economic behavior or behavior for institutional reasons as opposed to for economic reasons. All right. For the three of you who are still awake, I'm going to jump into the second part, which is Sprouts. So Sprouts Farmers Market, and again, I'm going to go through this quickly. The slides will be there. You can play me back in slow motion. No, just joking. No. If you really want to know, I don't think anyone wants to subject themselves to that. But I'm going to go through this quickly, and we can dive into aspects of this in the Q&A if you so wish. But Sprouts is an example of a pattern that is number three from the prior list of above average long duration growers that the market is missing, in my view. First, a disclaimer, I'm not recommending stocks. I don't have a newsletter. I'm not telling you should buy it or shouldn't buy it. You should do your own work. And my point here is to illustrate a live example, show the pattern in action, and show my investment process, help you learn, and hopefully, you know, you reach your own conclusion. So don't take this as investment advice in any shape or form. All right. So the thesis is pretty straightforward. Sprouts is a differentiated grocery business, has attractive unit economics. It has pretty underappreciated unit growth potential, and a new management that's over the last 2 years has been doing very sensible things to help it achieve that potential. So the idea here is, again, I promised to go through this quickly, the Sprouts caters to a different set of customers. It mainly looks at health enthusiasts and experience seekers. It has a lot of organics. It has a lot of vitamins, bulk products. It has a very differentiated assortment at a low price. And it's a regional grocer, so it's smaller than a lot of the big players and is able to source a lot of local stuff that a big chain might not be able to effectively because there's just not enough supply to fill the chain. So they have both fairly attractive prices, but also they also have an SKU assortment that has little overlap with mainstream grocers and maybe even with larger chains like Whole Foods, for instance. So I'm going to use kind of the lens of the five-step research process. That's what I actually do, you know, when I'm not talking to you guys and Graham, you know, and go through the five steps. And the purpose of the five-step process is just figure out two questions. One is, how predictable is the long-term economic outcome of the business? And two is, what's a reasonable range of intrinsic values? So we're going to start with company quality assessment, which rests on business quality, management quality, and balance sheet quality. And again, going through this quickly, I think that the industry is above average in terms of its attractiveness. You have some barriers to entry, location, brand, reputation, habit. You have low power buyers. You have low power suppliers. Yeah, you know, there are some threats of substitution of eating out, but usually you can't, most of us shouldn't or can't eat out all the time. So it's usually a complement, not a substitute to at least to a degree. And the competitive intensity is there. But in the segment of the industry where Sprouts competes, it's medium because it's based on the shopping experience and assortment as well as price, not purely on price. Now, competitive advantage is important. And here you have a habit of loyal customers. It's very important. They have a very high repeat rate of shoppers. And in consumer good companies, I think habit is frequently underestimated. And I'll show you in a second, they have a very high net promoter score among repeat customers, which is pretty impressive, indicative of the strong brand. And they have optimal regional scale. And what that scale allows them to do is it allows them to be the most important customer, maybe for a regional farm, because they can essentially take all of its output or a good majority. But that their scale isn't so big that they can't, doesn't make sense for them to deal with that farm because they are just, that farm would not be able to fill enough of the stores with product for it to bother. So they have this optimal scale, and they are able to have a differentiated assortment in different stores that caters to the local, both supply, but also local demand. So here is the net promoter score I mentioned, which is pretty high. NPS of 70 is very high. Again, it's a little bit biased because it's among frequent shoppers, but still, it's pretty impressive. Another way I like to validate quality of the business and competitive advantage is economic profits and return on capital. So economic profits, simply, you know, if you think about return on capital minus cost of capital and the difference between those two multiplied by the capital employed, that's what economic profits is. And you want it to be going up and to the right, and it largely is. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. So management, I really like the CEO and how he talks, but that's potentially a behavioral bias. I think he has a great background. He was a EVP of the grocery business at Walmart, and he was CEO of a small box retailer. He's also, his early actions are very sensible. He's clearly focused on return on capital and not just focused on growth for growth's sake, but on the economics of that growth. The incentive, the tracking is still too early. It's been only a couple of years, and COVID kind of interrupted things. But I think that, you know, he certainly improved morale some, and I know it's dangerous to look at Glassdoor a little bit, but I found turnarounds or improvement stories, and this is not quite a turnaround, but as aspects of it, you know, having management improve the morale is a good KPI to look for in terms of progress. CEO does own $5 million in equity, which is probably not his whole net worth, but it's not insignificant. So I would say management, based on what I can tell so far, is above average. The balance sheet is fine. We can dive into that if you want. And let's talk about the next step, which is, what are the few things that you want to know, the key economic variables? And for retailers, unit economics, same store sales growth, and the number of units in maturity. The unit economics of the new unit that they reduced the cost to build are exceptional. They're supposed to be 40% by year four, cash on cash return. We'll see if that actually pans out, but that's the intent, and that's the model that they're operating to. The other thing, and this is important to the story, the old management had a discounting strategy, and the new management said that doesn't make sense. They did a research that said only about 6% of their customers are really that price sensitive, but we are marking down a whole lot of our stuff to retain that 6%, and it doesn't pay off. So you can see over here, when management took over in 2019, gross margins were in the low 30s. Now, and this is not just from COVID, this is, you know, pre-COVID as well, even in Q4 of 2019, they're in the mid-30s and even close to the high 30s in some cases. So that's an intentional strategy, and that's both boosting profitability and returns. And I think that that makes a lot of sense, and I like that approach. Now, you can see same store sales growth. All of these numbers are positive, so this doesn't really qualify as a turnaround. But you can see why new management was brought in, because after a period of rapid growth in the middle of the last decade, the last few years, growth really stalled to low, very low single digits. And the boost you see in 2020, that's COVID. Right, so we don't want to give management credit for it. But the actions, the seeds that management is planting in 2019, and what they're doing is that they're raising prices effectively. They're getting rid of the 6% of customers who care about the prices. What that is causing is negative sales growth for a few quarters. But once you churn off those customers and start to anniversary that, the 94% of people who, by the way, are probably over 100% of profit, because the 6% are unprofitable customers, that's going to grow. And that's the plan. We're about to find out if that's going to happen, but that's the plan. So in terms of the number of stores, the company had 363 stores in 23 states. You know, they think they can add 300 to 400 units pretty easily over time. That makes sense. Whole Foods, for example, and Trader Joe's both have over 500 units, and they have bigger boxes, meaning that the smaller the box, the more storage in general you are likely to have. And just thinking about this, look at how few areas these guys are in. You know, so conceptually, if it works in these areas, it's not unreasonable to think it's going to work in other areas. It might not. There might be differences in supply or preferences or competitive dynamics, but it's certainly not unreasonable, and they have a lot of fill-in growth as well in the markets they're already in. So I like to think about financial modeling as a range, in the worst case and the best case, with the base case being the most likely. So the way I think about this business is, no, the market is thinking about this, oh no, COVID helped them last year, their earnings are going to shrink, right? And we don't like it. And that's true. They earned $2.50 last year. They were earning $1.30 pre-COVID. And this, the market is saying, well, earnings are going down. We don't want to invest. You know, that I think is basically what's happening. I think normalized mid-cycle earnings adjusted for the COVID benefit are just under $2. And even in the worst case, I think that they're above the historical levels. And the reason is twofold. One is they have more stores since those times, but also their gross margins are much higher because they've improved gross margins by several percent. And both of those factors are important to note. So I'm trying to do my best to normalize here for the COVID, and this is my best stab at what normal looks like adjusted for COVID. So valuation, again, naturally follow, what is the business going to grow at? What is that stream of cash flow worth? I think that low single-digit sales growth and high single-digit square footage growth is very reasonable, but they have to prove it. They still haven't proven it quite yet. And if that's the case, I think the stock is close to half of my intrinsic value estimate. There is some downside to the worst case, but it's moderate. You know, the range is appropriately wide. By the way, if you ever see a very narrow range, you know, either you're really, really good at estimating values or you might be overconfident in your ability to do so. I'll let you figure out which one it is. But there is some downside, but it's fairly moderate and the risk reward is fairly attractive. Now, as a sanity check, the stock is trading at about 12 and a half times normalized earnings. And essentially it's discounting no square footage growth and just low single digit sales growth. That's one way of thinking about what the price implies. So that's the set of expectations that we're betting against. I'm going to skip through the sensitivity. You can look at it later or can ask me about it. A behavioral checklist, I would say I like the CEO's language a lot. He's humble, thorough, he doesn't brag, he tries to deliver, he talks about the good as well as the bad. So I'm biased towards liking that as opposed to the usual promotional CEO who does the opposite. So there's a danger that I'm giving higher probability of success to his actions and it's warranted. And I'm trying to be evidence-based and try to counteract that bias. But other than that, all the usual biases apply, but nothing else specifics jumps out. Always risks. Competition is always the biggest risk, right? The natural questions are like, why can't a large chain crush them? Why can't Whole Foods plus Trader Joe's crush them? That they haven't. These guys have grown in spite of those companies. They have done very well in spite of those companies, but things can change. So that's always probably number one risk. Number two risk is managers are optimistic about the economics of the units or their ability to expand to as many locations as they think they can. Those are things I'm watching for as well. I'll briefly just mention how I size position and then open it up to questions. For me, a small position is 5%, medium is 10, large is 15 at cost. And to become a larger position, not just the price, the value relationship needs to be better, but you also need to be a better business. So for me, this is a medium position, and that's because I think the business is above average in quality, and you have moderate downside to worst case, and you have above average balance sheet management. So it's a combination of margin of safety from the qualitative attributes of the investment, as well as from the quantitative price to value relationship. I will skip some of that. My portfolio, it's concentrated 10 to 20 investments, typically on the low end of that. I don't short, I don't have any margin, I don't use leverage. I'm really trying to safely compound my and my partner's capital for the long term. Most of my family's money is in the partnership. I don't have a personal account where I trade things that I don't invest in the partnership. You know, this is the main event. So I'm really trying to be careful and do my best. If I'm going to err on the side of omission and missing out on something rather than taking a risk and losing our money rather than going for broke and ending up broke. That's just at least my philosophy and makes sense to me. This slide says, don't sue me, please do your own work. And let's do Q&A. And I'll leave this final slide up. This is, you know, I have what I call the owner's manual, where I describe my investment process in complete detail. That's kind of my covenant between myself and my partners. If any of you want to, please, you know, send me an email, request it. I'll be delighted to send it to you. And you know, hopefully there's something in there that you can learn from. With that, Graham, I'm all yours for questions.
All righty. Well, for those of you out in the audience, hopefully you enjoyed that presentation. As Gary said, you can flip back through the presentation at any point in time and look through those slides, and there will be a full recording here on YouTube and Guru Focus once we finish up. So if you do want to take the time to go back to them, they will be available there for you. For those of you, our international audience members, welcome. Gary, looks like we got some people joining from Portugal, Moscow, Switzerland, Peru even, so all over the world. An additional one from Germany a little further down here. So welcome to all of you. Coming in down here at the bottom just now as we were finishing up there, looks like Rick is telling us Morningstar lists Sprouts key competitors as Kroger, Target, Walmart. He says that's some pretty stiff competition. Any thoughts there? Agree, disagree? Any feelings there?
It is stiff competition, and I think the key there is, do they have a niche with a different target customer and a different, and I'll you know, refer back to kind of the health enthusiasts and the experience seekers, right? So I think you have to remember that the people who show up at Sprouts also shop at those other places. So it's a lot of, for them, it's frequently a second shop a week. It's not their only shop. So it's not either or. It's really a question of, is there enough differentiation and assortment and the value that's there? And I think that's the key. The CEO gets asked about pricing pressure and, you know, all these other things, which are very legitimate questions all the time. And his response has been that, look, you have, a very low overlap in the SKUs with those major players. And he would know because he ran the Walmart grocery business. So he's not speaking out of ignorance here. He's speaking from full knowledge of what it is to run one of the biggest national grocers in the country, right? So I think that's the key, is that they have a differentiated assortment, and they're also targeting a differentiated, you know, customers who value that, right? They're not targeting, you know, the person who's looking just to buy milk and Coca-Cola and all of that stuff. They don't carry a Coca-Cola or something like that, even although I could be wrong on that. And they have a much higher organic ratio in their stores. And that's the qualitative answer. The qualitative answer is, look, Kroger, Target, all those players have been around, but this company has been able to grow both same-store sales and number of stores over time. So the evidence is in the results. And then maybe the question to see the point is, well, could they be hitting a ceiling? Is the slowdown growth the last several years, is that evidence that something has changed, or evidence that perhaps the concept has reached its maximum size? And that would be the antithesis or the alternative hypothesis, so to speak. And as we look at evidence, I'm trying to be as dispassionate as possible in interpreting the information to say, is it more likely that my thesis is right, that they do have the runway and they can do it profitably, or that actually, no, something has changed?
Definitely. And I'll put a question out there that's one of our more frequent ones, since I do think it ties in relatively well to your presentation. We hear a lot of debate and differing opinions from our guests here joining us on leaning towards the company financials, the metrics, things like that, and leaning more towards management. Do you find yourself trying to find a balance between the two, or leaning more one way or another? Does one make more of an impact, in your opinion?
You know, it's interesting. Like, I started out as a much more of a numbers guy, right? You know, it's all in the numbers. If you pay a cheap price, it'll take care of itself. And I've shifted away from that view, but I certainly have not gravitated to, like, hey, just find great people and the rest takes care of itself, which is not wrong. There's all of those are appropriate styles. And just as an aside, I teach a value investing seminar to business school students. And I always tell them, you know, your job is to figure out, customize what you learn from great investors and figure out your own strengths and weaknesses and structure your process around that, not just copy. So there are many right ways to do it. They depend to a large degree on you and your situation. I would say that, you know, I'm certainly gotten uncomfortable investing with bad management. Like, you know, if people are very clearly either just incompetent in, say, capital allocation, or they are dishonest, it's just full stop, no go. You cannot be the dishonest management. You can't, really can't. You know, they're inside. They probably have the board tied up with their buddies from the golf club. And, you know, like, you know, they're just not, you know, it's just such a, I mean, there are people who do it, and kudos to them, you know, the activists, but, you know, that's by and large not my approach. I think I want people to have a basic level of integrity and a basic level of competence. That's my minimum. And the question is, how much do you pay for amazing management? Well, I would love to have amazing management, but can I find it without paying too much for it? And that's the question. So frequently I settle for good enough, and that might sound, you know, unexciting, you know, but the truth is, you have to think about overlapping my circle of competence, or in this case, your circle of competence, to where the biggest spread is between, you know, market implied expectations and your view of reality. And frequently, the best companies, I don't have an edge in figuring out why they should be worth more than the market thinks that they should be. But sometimes I can find above average businesses, maybe they're not perfect by any means, and Sprouts probably is definitely in that category. But there's a big spread between what I think it's worth and what the market thinks. So I tend to, I would say, and I track this. I actually have a management score as well as a business score, balance sheet score for all of my holdings. And to answer your question, one is the best management teams, five is the worst, and three is average. My current management score is in the low twos. So it's above average, but not perfect. At least not, I don't think they're perfect. But hey, I'm not perfect either. So makes both of us.
Absolutely. And looks like Rick is tossing out here also another one that he's been keeping an eye on is Aldi's. He's been saying they've been growing quickly where he lives. If you have a comment on it, great. If not, we can continue on there.
Unfortunately, nothing useful to add. As Charlie Munger says, nothing to add.
All right. Well, it looks like another question just before that actually is asking if you have any thoughts on Boeing, seeing a potential turnaround after their kind of getting that 737 MAX issue behind them. Any thoughts there?
No, and I think I might answer all of the questions where it's really not my goal to kind of give opinions on stocks, live. You know, I use Sprouts as an example, so I guess in a way I did, but it's to illustrate the process and to illustrate an example of an investing pattern, kind of as opposed to just talk at a high level. But I just think in general, whether I have an opinion or not, I want to kind of stay away from things that start to border on stock advice, so I'm going to pass.
Fair enough. And for those of you out in the audience, keep that in mind, trying to avoid asking those opinions on stock questions. We're not here to provide any advice for you. We want to talk about investing and investing knowledge, which on that note, a question from Abel, do you use any stock screeners as part of your research process, any that you heavily rely upon?
Yeah, so I do, although I would say over time, screening has become, so I have four sources of ideas. Screening is one of them. I have three others. I'm happy to elaborate if anyone wants to. For screening, I built my own. So I have Bloomberg, I have a data feed into my Excel spreadsheet. And what I look for typically is 7-year free cash flow yield and 7-year return on capital. So I want at least a decent business, which means return on capital should be above cost of capital over a full cycle. And I find that as a valuation metric, 7-year free cash flow yield gets rid of frauds, a lot of frauds, because a lot of frauds don't have free cash flow. It also gets rid of a lot of accounting gimmicks in terms of people adjusting earnings. Free cash flow is free cash flow. You can't adjust it. You can manipulate it sometimes, but it's much harder than just earnings. So that's what I kind of look for. But I would say if you're looking for one that's in the public domain, I actually think Morningstar, if you have a premium subscription, has a pretty nice screener. They have their fair value estimates on maybe 1,000 companies or so. And not to say that they're always the same as mine, and frequently they're somewhat different, but they have an intrinsic value approach. And you can certainly screen based on the price to f their fair value. They also have a mode rating of like wide, narrow, none. So you can overlap that. So that's one source. There's also Joel Greenblatt's The Magic Formula. I think it's magicformulainvesting.com or something like that. It's free, just register. And you set the minimum market cap and it gives you 50 stocks that screen the best based on his magic formula, which is, if for those of you who don't know, they rank EV to EBIT, so enterprise value to operating income, and then basically return, measure of return on invested capital. And it's a way of trying to find good and cheap as opposed to cheap. So those are two kind of free or close to free things in the public domain. I do look at it occasionally, but I have my own as well.
Absolutely. And for those of you out there in the audience, maybe new to the Guru Focus site, having used it before, we do offer some screeners like that as well. We do have a pre-made Magic Formula one as well to quickly get you started there. Looks like Ted down at the bottom was actually chiming in as well, asking for to elaborate on those three sources of investment ideas. So it looks like we got there for you, Ted. Obviously, you can always go out and create your own kind of screeners. We have our all-in-one screener on Guru Focus to create your own fully customized one. So do please feel free to explore there. Looks like we did actually hit on another one of our questions that you mentioned briefly, using free cash flow to kind of rule out potential fraud there. Are there any other metrics specifically on that note that are ruling out fraud for you there?
Well, just maybe to come back to Ted's question, was he asking about the three sources of ideas that were not screening related, or was he talking about the screening? So I'm happy to elaborate on the three other things. I don't know if that's what he was referring to in his
Looks
question.
like it was just a general question of those three sources of investment ideas there.
So let me elaborate. So the screening is one. The other three, one is I have an inventory of companies I've basically looked at and identify as good companies, and I look for price dislocation among really good kind of businesses so that I can then do work really quickly and then find out if they're potentially mispriced. I also really am fond of special situations, so things like post bankruptcies, spin-offs, or corporate reorganizations and such, because they play to that behavioral bias pattern. And there are various ways to find them. You can search for filings, you can have Google Alerts. If you have Bloomberg, there are ways to find them there as well. And finally, and I'm not ashamed to admit it, I really do, like to get idea candidates from like-minded investors. And my favorite sources for that is not necessarily the most well-known investors, because unfortunately, like if we could call up Warren Buffett and say, Mr. Buffett, if you were managing $100 million, or $200 million, what would be your best five investing ideas? That would be awesome. But the reality is, what Buffett is buying for Berkshire is not necessarily reflective of what he would be buying if he were not constrained by size. And the same is true for a lot of really well-known investors. So I think what I find most useful is a network of peers of people who've been doing this 10 to 30 years. I've done this for 20 years, but somewhere in that range who maybe have their own funds out there, and they are people who speak the same language, the same intrinsic value methodology. We have different preferences, different styles. So I never, no, the idea isn't to take someone's idea and buy it. The idea is to use it as one of the inputs into the funnel and then do your own work and decide. And frankly, I found that that is probably the most fruitful source of ideas, because if you think about screening has gotten very much commoditized versus maybe 20 years ago. And I think that I would say the best ideas have come from either the special situation bucket or from other thoughtful value investors, to be honest.
Absolutely. And on that note, and I'll kind of bring in a question here from Federico. As far as that investing universe goes, I guess. Are you limiting yourself? He's asking specifically to developed markets, or do you like to reach out into some of the more kind of actively developing markets like China, things like that, if you're seeing valuations are cheap there?
So I don't do China. I came from the former Soviet Union, so I have a strong degree of suspicion of communist regimes. Not against anyone, but because the criteria, there has to be quality financial statements in English that I can understand. The market has to be relatively free, you know, and at least, you know, the market has to be the major determinant of outcomes, not the government. And I think that there needs to be a rule of law. You know, so that in practice restricts me to develop markets. I've done things in Europe and Australia and New Zealand, and you know, I've looked at you know, Canada, US, basically North America, Europe, and you know, so now there are probably markets I should do, but I haven't figured out yet, like say South Korea, or maybe Japan. Like I've not done Japan, South Korea. I think I don't fully understand the culture there, and I'm a little bit afraid that things will look cheap and I will be the patsy at the table. But I suppose that those are doable. But in practice, I have a small, nimble pool of capital. There's enough stuff to do within the universe I outlined that I don't need to stretch my circle of competence that much to find good ideas most of the time.
Absolutely. And is there, I guess one we'll toss out there, further complicate the question a little bit more. Is there any particular industries per se that you try and absolutely stray away from or that you really lean into?
So I, you know, my lens is that I was a microeconomic investor, meaning that I really like to be answering the kinds of questions we talked about, David Sprouse, competitive dynamics, competitive advantage, you know, customer, product customer fit, you know, ability to grow, management, capital allocation. Those are the questions I like to take on. What I don't want to do is to take on big macro questions because I have no edge. I like to have the opposite of an edge, a disadvantage. And so naturally that eliminates, a lot of commodity industries like the oil industry and so forth. I'm not very comfortable with levered financials. I tried in my past history to do some banks at the prior firm where I managed the fund. And you know, I actually did okay, but I just left the experience realizing that I don't know enough and I just don't have the specialized knowledge. And also, I'm not a venture capitalist in the public markets, right? I'm trying to invest in companies that have already shown a track record of success. Maybe that success has been interrupted, or maybe there's some, something else that market is missing. But I'm not trying to figure out some new business model where there's no earnings record and or maybe 2-3 years of a record and find the next Microsoft. That's a very legitimate way to invest, but it's outside of my circle of competence. But in practice, that eliminates, say, early stage biotech companies or early stage technology companies. And I really like companies with a history of free cash flow, high returns on capital, slow share changes, market share changes, because again, I'm trying to guard against adverse negative change, right? How do you lose money? Well, one way is to use leverage, but let's say you don't use leverage. Well, you buy something and it turns out to earn a fraction of what you thought it did. For example, early in my career as an analyst, I recommended a company by the name of Faro. The ticker was FOE, which maybe should have been a clue, but maybe it wasn't the most friendly of stocks for me. To keep the story short, I thought mid-cycle earnings were $2.50. Turned out, after a decade looking back, they were 25 cents. That's pretty humbling, right? So I try to eliminate businesses that are too fragile to have the kind of predictive ability about the range of values that I would like. So I do a lot. I do some parts of healthcare. I do part of a lot of consumer. I do industrials. Those are kind of, probably bread and butter. But I'm not focused on Geek's classification of the industry. I'm focused on the economics and do I understand the business. And the best litmus test was one, I was a group dinner with Buffett 18, 19 years ago. And he said the first question he asks is, can I look out 5 to 10 years into the future and approximately estimate the key economic characteristics of the business? So that's my first question for any company or industry, and that naturally guides the way.
Understood. And looks like another question rolling in here. If I can poke on a little bit overall of the overall market at this point, Praveen's just asking any views on inflation and where we might see the market going, if you want to hit at that.
Yeah, so it's funny. One of my old, we went marketing at my old firm, and we were in Canada. We did a breakfast with financial advisors, and we did this presentation about how, you know, we're long-term, intrinsic value, we care about the business. And then this advisor comes up to me after breakfast and says, listen, no, so do you know where the market is going to be in 3 months? And I thought he was like pulling my leg. He's like, I was expecting, aha, gotcha. And he's dead serious. And I'm like, dude, did you just eat all the donuts and breakfast and ignore what we were saying? Like, I didn't know. But in all seriousness, I think the way I think about the market is not about predicting where it's going to go, because I don't believe it's possible, and it's certainly not possible by me. I like to understand where we are. And I think Howard Marks has a great mental model for that, in terms of, in this first book, kind of listing all the things that, you know, maybe argue for that the market is towards the euphoric end, and versus other things that's towards the kind of more bound or the pessimistic end, right? And overall, there's clearly a lot more optimism than pessimism. I think right now the market has kind of three tiers. There is the tier of companies that are clearly bubble companies, whether it's meme stocks or crazy companies, this valuations just make almost no sense or no sense, right? That's a tier. But there's also a tier, a very large tier of very expensive stocks or very good businesses. And that tier, whether the prices are right or not, they're not priced irrationally, they're priced optimistically, but the optimism might be justified. And furthermore, coming back to inflation, it will certainly be proved justified if rates stay low for decades. So just mathematically, for those of you who don't know, if you do a DCF, a high growth business increases in value more if interest rates drop and you drop your discount rate percentage-wise than a low growth business. That just, you know, that's the math. Go try it in the spreadsheet. I had to do it in the spreadsheet a few years ago myself to convince myself, but that's the math. So the third tier is companies or industries are completely out of favor and they're very cheap, right? And I have a bunch of those. And sometimes I think maybe I have too many. Like, I have stocks that are 7x earnings and they report good results. They go to 6x earnings. And you're like, hey, well, what will it take? But then you just believe in the process. And I've done this long enough that I know it works its way out at some point. So I think that those are the three tiers. The cheap tier has a lot of companies that might be broken businesses as well. So the cheap tier is not all companies I think are undervalued. Some of those problems are quite real, and those companies might go bankrupt and be permanently impaired. But those are the three tiers. Coming back to inflation, I think it's an impossible question to answer. I actually do have an inflation hedge, a tail hedge in the portfolio, on top of the traditional answer, which is pricing power of companies hopefully will offset inflation. And I think part of it is because, well, I don't know the outcome, the probability. Because look, here's what's happening, right? You have a bunch of well-dressed men and women at the Federal Reserve and kind of their circle of friends think that they can control a very wild beast, right? And the problem is, you know, a lot of other people in the past have thought they could control this beast and they failed, right? But this is kind of like the inside view. If you think about thinking fast and slow versus the outside view, you know that other people have failed, but you say, yes, they failed, but I have special powers. I can really get this beast locked down. And so they're telling us not to worry. This is all transient. And it's highly likely that they're overestimating their ability to control things. But I don't know. And so I'm not worried about inflation going from 2% to 4 or 5% for a period of time. But if they really mess up, and as a consequence of their actions to prop up the economy, they really go off the cliff, and we have some kind of tail event, I want to be covered. So I basically bought very cheap insurance against a catastrophic event, but I am comfortable enough with kind of just inflation rising, say, to mid-single digits, that I don't feel the need to do anything special to guard against that other than, you know, normal portfolio construction and stock selection.
Gotcha. And thanks for diving in on that one. And I'll put another one out there, one that's come up recently in the last couple of ones of our guest presentations. As far as presentation, or as far as your portfolio and holdings versus cash in it, are you maintaining some cash that you can potentially dump into things? Not necessarily betting on a crash per se, but something along those lines, just in case you see something wild happen that you want to jump on something?
It's a very interesting problem because you have a very dangerous market where at the high level, you know that, you know, we're far closer to, you know, euphoria than we are to the midpoint of the kind of the market cycle. But I'm a bottom-up investor, and I happen to find a group of stocks that are very, very mispriced in my view. So my average, you know, my portfolio is trading at 55% or so of my base case estimate of value. And there's no company in there that's trading above 70%. So what do you do with that? Because I struggle with this a lot. It's a great question. Because if I weren't finding any values, I would totally let cash rise as a bottom-up residual, and it would act in exactly the way the person asking the question was asking, which it would act as a call option on future opportunities. Problem is, I would be just basically market timing of selling a portfolio, some portion of a portfolio or individual parts of it that are, say, 60 cents on the dollar value. That's a big opportunity cost. So what I'm actually fully invested now, believe it or not, but I have hedges against, not just against inflation, but against a number of things. So if there were a market collapse tomorrow, those hedges would likely produce anywhere between 15 and 25% extra cash for me to deploy in that. And I'm paying a price for it, you know, but I think the price is worth it because I think that the companies that I'm invested in are very attractive, and I'll be better off having a small hedge plus be fully invested in them than selling a significant chunk of the portfolio and having cash plus, say, 70% or 75% in stocks. But in general, I let the bottom up drive that consideration. I let my portfolio sizing guidelines drive that. And I'm an absolute value investor, meaning that my buys are disconnected from my sells. So a relative value investor, which is most mutual funds, says, well, I have to be 95% or more invested because otherwise my risk police comes and slaps me and says, what are you doing? You're a bad little person. You go to the boss in the corner if you don't, invest that cash. I've actually seen it happen. I've actually seen it, you know, at one of my large private firms, and I don't want to name by name, like the portfolio manager was told, if you don't invest it by the end of the week, we'll invest it for you, you know, in like ETFs or so, in indices or something like that. I don't have that. And so if something hits my sell point based on my sell discipline, if there's nothing that hits my buy point, cash is the natural stopping over place. And right now, I wish there were more things hitting my sell point, which would mean that things were working out. But right now I was able to find a bunch of things that are really cheap, and I'm pretty excited about them, and they're a pretty diverse group of companies too. It's not like it's all one industry or something like that. So, but I'm at the same time very, very nervous about the amount of euphoria and liquidity and just rank speculation that's happening. And I'm very much aware that the danger bells are ringing.
Absolutely. And another question coming in from Ted here, which I think is a curious one to pose. You mentioned, you know, having a group of like-minded investors as being a very valuable tool for actually going out, finding new ideas, consulting, things like that. Yeah. Would you say that at any point in time, that circle can get too big and you can run into a danger of consulting too many people and actually creating confusion in your own mind?
Oh, no. I mean, there's no confusion because I'm not consulting them or asking them for advice on what to invest in. What I'm doing is, well, there are a few people who I would say I trust them as sounding boards, and maybe we'll have those discussions where, think of it as resistance training, right, in the gym. The other person might, you know, like, for instance, I've got together a group of investors and we form what I call a devil's advocate club, where someone presents an idea and then there's a person who's assigned and given a couple of weeks to present the strongest possible negative case on it, right? And then the other members, when the devil's advocate presents, ask questions. We haven't done this in a bit. Should you're one of those listening, which I doubt, but let's get back to that. The point, though, is that you're trying to debias yourself and minimize behavioral biases. I think as far as idea generation, I don't think you can have too wide of a group as long as each person has earned your respect, because I think having a wide top of funnel is really good. Because once something is in the top of my funnel, I erase the source. I do this about 8 times a year. Basically, every month that's not earnings month or so, I run my idea generation cycle, and I will start with 200 things at the top. So I let things in really easily. That's my first step. My second step is kill them, if I can at all, for anything that is at all bad. Like, so if I know, for instance, that I don't want a company that's over-levered, not saying I don't, but most of the time I don't, and I see something is clearly over-levered, I just kill it right there and erase it. That usually leaves maybe 20 or so investments that come out the bottom. And that's where, you know, I rank order them based on various factors, and I usually work with two or three at a time. So I think that to say that, can you have too many people? I think too many would only be meaningful if that you were diluting the quality. As long as the person is compatible with me, speaks the same language, and also is pleasant to interact, because look, you know, we're all human. Like, if someone is a complete jerk, but they're a brilliant jerk, I'll pass. I'm okay. There's enough good, smart people out there that I'll pass on a brilliant jerk. But other than that, no, I don't think they can have too many.
All righty. Well, that is going to run us up right against our time frame at this point. Thank you so much, Gary, for taking the time again to come out, give a great presentation, join us for these questions. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Graham. And if anyone, again, wants the owner's manual, feel free to shoot me an email. I'll be happy to send it to you. Take care now.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode of Value Investing Live. If you haven't joined one of our live streams before, check us out on YouTube and register for the events on gurufocus.com. If it's your first time hearing of us, click the link in the bio for a free 7-day trial of Guru Focus, where you can test out all of our great tools and features. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.